And this might be a hot take, Scott. When you take a solutions leader who's sales oriented and value minded and put them in responsible for the CS team, the magnitude of impact is substantially more than taking a CS person and having them run the SE motion.
When should I start thinking about making my first hire or standing up a solutions or pre-sales team?
You know, a lot of companies think, oh, let's hire implementation. Let's hire someone to handle that. Get someone that can do both, right?
What KPIs are you giving your first couple solutions engineers?
So one, making sure what was purchased was implemented and really finding that key success metric. Like, what are they looking to do from a business perspective?
What is one widely held belief that revenue leaders hold today that you think is bullshit or no longer serving us?
That people actually care about their customers. I think it's bullshit. Because it's a lot easier to sell to current customers than new customers right now. And if you haven't given a shit about them because after you've signed that dotted line, you're nowhere to be found, churn's coming for you.
Behind the scenes, it was a small group of people that were doing everything.
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
I want to know how this insane growth actually happens.
What are you doing when no one's around, no one's looking? Are you just showing up and doing a minimum? Or are you approaching it like a pro? Be a student of the game.
This episode is brought to you by POCUS. POCUS turns data into revenue. It's really that simple. They help you combine all product usage and intent signals your team needs to prioritize the best opportunities and take quick action. POCUS helps you build pipeline based on real buying signals, not your team's best guess, whether that's landing new logos or expanding existing ones. With POCUS, go-to-market teams at Asana, Canva, Miro, and Loom, incredible companies, save 10 plus hours a week digging through data to find and close deals with confidence. So if you want to create focus for your team with POCUS, go see it in action by requesting a demo at POCUS.com/demo. That's POCUS.com/demo. And let's get it rocking.
Hello and welcome back to the GTM podcast. Your host here, Scott Barker. Thanks as always for rocking with us. This week has been rocking. Holy, feels like we're recording this on a Friday. It feels like we packed like a month worth of work this week. I don't know if you're feeling the same, my man, but I'm joined by James Kakis. James, welcome, man.
Hey, thanks, Scott. It's great to be here. And I'm feeling it too. We feel like we've been rocking and rolling. Our team was talking. Right now, we're kind of at like everyone's working 6-7 days, just putting in the work right now, but we're feeling that momentum. And this has been like one of the longest weeks that I can remember, but it's all good, right? When you're doing good work and you're getting good outcomes, there's no complaints.
We were talking about that last night at the team. I think everyone was still in our office at like 7:30 p.m. and just like doing a team check-in. I'm like, yeah, all right, how are we doing? And we're like, you know, we're good. It's like, it's rewarding work. So like, yes, we're working hard. Yes, this is a little bit insane. But when you get that momentum from the market and things are clicking and working, I find it's much easier to keep going. It's gives energy rather than takes it away, you know?
Yeah. And I will say, like, maybe an unpopular opinion, like, that's why I miss the office sometimes. Like, you know, I actually miss those like 5, 6, 7, 8 p.m. nights in the office with some of your colleagues. I feel like I built great relationships, like working side by side with people on those late nights. That's the one thing I do miss, being in this remote first environment.
Yeah. That was one of the reasons we got an office. I was a huge proponent of, you know, remote work, and I worked remote for like 6 years. And then, you know, as we started doing kind of just harder things, things were getting crazy. It's like, I need people around me. I need the energy. And especially when you also like, you're trying to empower maybe like some younger talent things. It's just like, it's really nice to have folks close by and kind of learn from us all just a little bit, you know.
Totally. And I think like that osmosis thing is something that's really important. I was talking to a big enterprise company that's bringing their whole SMB team back to the office. And it's that reason, right? They're making everyone hire in office moving forward because they want you to sit next to somebody and learn how they do things and interact with them. And I've done a little research on this too, Scott. Like, the data right now says that job affinity is at an all-time low. And I think that's because we're in our remote first environment, right? Like, I like the flexibility I like being at home, but I don't have as deep a relationship with some of my colleagues and my coworkers because we're working, you know, next to each other. And so I think it's just a really interesting trend to keep an eye on as companies start to shift to more, you know, hybrid and in-person demands in the office.
Yeah. Always a hot button topic. So I'm sure we'll have people weighing in on that, where they stand at pros and cons of both, of course. Just taking a quick step back, I always love to do a quick bio for those listeners. So James is currently the Chief Solutions Officer at TestBox, an incredible company that we're very, very proud of in our GTM fund portfolio, doing some really cool things and super relevant to the audience and the listener. Of course, we never do like full plugs, but it is technology you want to have your eye on for sure if you are a revenue leader or a founder. So we'll talk a little bit about it. And also limited partner in GTM fund. So we appreciate your support there. But you've got a breadth of background and it really starts, as, you know, director of solutions engineering. You spent a lot of your career in solutions engineering. You were at Showpad, for 4 years, then moved over to Salesforce. So two incredible companies, great runs there. And then you actually founded, the Presales Collective. You had the Presales podcast. You kind of owned and really elevated that category for close to 4 years. And then you had a successful exit. So congratulations there. We'll talk a little bit about that. And now, of course, you've gone back to operator. How's the transition from entrepreneur to operator again?
Yeah, it's a great question. And truthfully, I got to give Sam, my CEO, a lot of credit, right? One of the things that I was thinking after I built my own business and, you know, co-founded Presales Collective with Yuji Higashi, I just was like, wow, I love all this accountability and responsibility. Like, I like actually, you know, being responsible for making these tough decisions. And when I was figuring out going back to tech, like, do I want to work for somebody or do I want to start my own company again? You know, getting to know Sam, just an awesome person, right? So, you know, I feel very empowered to make a lot of decisions for the business. I am the Chief Solutions Officer, but it's a little bit of a catch 22 on the title because I'm actually head of go to market. So I'm overseeing marketing, revenue, customer success, which we're turning into really customer solutions. But it feels good. It feels good to be back, Scott. And I'll be honest, like, having such a good career in solutions engineering was so pivotal to me because I learned so much. I got, you know, exposure into different parts of different businesses. And so when I started my own business and learned what it was like and what it took, I was like, wow, this is a lot of work. And I feel like for me, Presales Collective was always the thing before the thing to see if I could do it and prove to myself I can do it. And so now that I'm in, you know, back in the tech, back in the early stage company who made a crazy pivot and is in a fast moving category, I feel so good to be back. You know, it feels good to be back in the operator role.
Oh yeah, man. I can feel your energy right now. And it's giving me life on this Friday, which is cool. And shout out to Sam, such an incredible founder and CEO. So let's talk about the title a little bit. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're, you know, basically in a CRO function, but you have this title of, you know, Chief Solutions Officer. Do you think that we're going to see that as a more common, title in the future? Maybe a slightly larger company, because traditionally maybe sales engineering or pre-sales, whatever you want to call it, hasn't had a slot at this around the C-suite table.
Totally. And you know, Scott, at Presales Collective, we used to always talk about the solutions engineering function getting a seat at the table. And I was one of those people always pushing it. But the more people I talked to in my network and the more I looked around and go to market motions, the more I realized that the profession, as it exists in most organizations today, has to evolve. Like, GTM is evolving, buyers evolving, customer experience is evolving. And so even in my comeback before TestBox, I started doing research and I started to find out that solutions leaders, imagine you run a solutions engineering team, started taking on more roles within the customer journey. So I've talked to like 3 or 4 dozen companies who their solution engineering leaders have maybe taken on professional services, solutions architecture. There's even cases that they've taken on customer success teams. There's even cases where they've actually gotten rid of their customer success teams and made them more product and value engineering focused. And so when I started to hear and see that, I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, this is actually a trend. I had a call with someone today who literally is a chief solutions officer and utilized the blog articles that we wrote about to name the function. And so I think that it's starting to gain some traction. I've heard chief solutions officer, chief experience officer. I spoke to one this week as well. I've had a lot of people say, hey, James, are you creating the chief customer officer all over again? And this might be a hot take, Scott, but the research that I've done and what I've even heard from venture capitalists is that when you take a solutions leader who's sales oriented and value minded and put them in responsible for the CS team, the magnitude of impact is substantially more than taking a CS person and having them run the SE motion. And that's no offense to anybody in those functions, but the way that we've been wired to think about value is something that I think is shifting, right? Because value is everyone's job now, right? With the pressure on go-to-market, massive convergence of a number of trends, value is everybody's job. So whether it's a chief solutions officer, head of customer solutions, I think this consolidated work function is the future of B2B technology.
I would agree. And I think, pre-sales is such a great learning environment to really go into anything. I think you can go and absolutely destroy it as an account executive. You make great sales leader, CS leader. It's just like you are brought in to showcase and create the value before someone is like fully bought it, right? And that is really what everyone is waking up to. It's like, okay, that's all of our jobs. That's always been our jobs. And this wasn't just one part of the org that was supposed to do this.
Totally. And I think like I even say that the pre-sales term, like this is one of the things I've talked about recently is like 18 months into pre-sales collective, I was like, I don't think pre-sales is the right term for this profession anymore. It's actually like a solutions profession because a lot of these sales engineers, solutions consultants are doing so much work with the install base. Upsell, expansion, renewal. Let's think about today, if someone buys technology and there's not adoption and utilization, like you bring in the solution consultant to help that function. And so I've even heard some organizations that are starting to ask their SEs to move into AEs to be quota carrying because they're more dangerous with the product. Now, the profession has always, been looked at as like the technical resource, but there's such a new wave of folks in this profession that are very business oriented, right? And I think that the role has to be what we call the sliding scale of technical. You got to talk to an admin of the product, but you got to talk to the CTO, but you're also presenting to a CRO, CEO, and you've got to be able to speak their language or you're never going to be dangerous enough in a go-to-market cycle. So I think that trend is super interesting, and that's what I'm really trying to keep my pulse on. And there's been amazing solutions leaders that, like, even when I took my next step where I wanted to own the revenue number and own the customer journey, I talked to a number of people who made that leap, and they were like, James, I rely on my solutions experience all the time. It really made me a better executive. So I'm trying to help, lead a path as well for people who want to make that same jump.
And I think I guess it depends on what your natural affinity is for, but, I think for many folks, the business acumen comes naturally. You spend enough time in this world and like you are going to pick up the business acumen. You're going to understand how to negotiate. You're going to understand how to run a proper, call from, beginning to end and how to manage stakeholders. Like that kind of just naturally comes, but building those technical chops, going the other way, isn't natural unless you seek it out, unless you spend the time, unless you get the training. And so building from a foundation of having those technical wherewithal, I think is much easier to build the business acumen than go the other way.
I agree with you, right? I think the idea of being technically curious is really important in this role, in this profession, right? You've got to be dangerous enough. Like, I think you got to have a point of view about the space, the industry, but you really got to know how products deliver value. And I think that is what's fundamentally important about this role. And I think that's where I'm starting to see a lot of change in the go-to-market motion is that you can no longer not have a point of view or be dangerous enough with your product or the value that your product's deriving, right? I've talked to a number of CS leaders who've said, James, like our team is unfortunately glorified support. Like that is how our organization has shifted. And we need these folks to be able to learn how to demo, how to do discovery, what value orientation and value frameworks are. And I think, again, it's no fault to the people in the profession. It's just been what a lot of our organizations have needed. And I think that shift of value, again, and being technically minded and business savvy is actually going to continue in every role within the function. Because every time you talk to a customer, it matters, right? Every single time you touch and you have a touch point with the customer, it really matters. And so you can't waste those by being an information passer or let me get back to you and go get, you know, all these people. Like that's, you can't do that in today's go-to-market motion.
Yeah. Yeah. We get folks, you know, listening from all sides of, you know, tech companies, but, you know, I think there is a lot from sort of like SMB mid-market. I would love your take on, you know, let's say I'm a founder listening to this or I'm a revenue leader listening to this. When should I start thinking about making my first hire or standing up a solutions or pre-sales team?
Yeah. Some of the things that we talked about with Pre-Sales Collective was bring these people on earlier, right? Let me give a little example about my Showpad experience. When I joined Showpad, I was the first SE, and most of our sellers were from ClearSlide. And if anyone remembers ClearSlide, it was a very easy product to stand up. They put you in a little trial, you would test it. When I got to Showpad, they put everybody in that same motion, except our product wasn't built for it. And so, you know, I had to go and spend a ton of time building POCs and building trials and kind of changing the go-to-market motion. So all that to say is if you've got a product where you've got to do POCs, you've got to do trials, people want to get hands-on with your product, getting the SE in there earlier is important because you want your AE to have a level of depth with the product. But if you're asking them to prospect, forecast, close business, and be a product expert, it's just a little bit too much. And I think for the early stage companies, because I think this is where I came from, is not only was I the sales engineer or solutions engineer selling the deal, but I had to do the implementation for the first little bit as well, because I knew that customer. And so I think if you're, you know, a lot of companies think, oh, let's hire implementation, let's hire someone to handle that. Get someone that can do both, right? Because then you have a better aligned customer journey. You know what was sold. There's a clear handoff. So once you're kind of thinking about how we implement and how we do those POCs, I think that's a perfect time to bring somebody in that you can help scale the account executive organization.
I love that, finding that person that can do both in the early days. And then what KPIs are you giving your first couple, solutions engineer?
You know, this is like, I would say the plague of the profession, right? Is that how do you actually measure the impact of this role, right? And what are the metrics that actually matter? And this is where a lot of the talk on the CSO has gone, is like, what are the revenue metrics that you matter? The way I like to look at things is, one, did we implement what the customer bought? Because if we think about a lot of go-to-market motions, teams sold, you know, A, B, C, and D. Implementation maybe only did A and B. And then customer success is just managing that account on A and B and not necessarily implementing C and D, right? That makes sense. So one, making sure what was purchased was implemented and really finding that key success metric. Like, what are they looking to do from a business perspective, right? People buy TestBox because they want to increase their win rates. They want to get more qualified customers into their product. Understanding that success metric is a key driver for the SE in that handover and in that deployment to make sure it goes well. And then the things that I've been really looking at, whether it's early stage or late stage, is how is that actually affecting product adoption and utilization, right? Whatever those metrics are for your business. And then if those drop and you need to increase them, what are the things that you're doing to increase them that ultimately turn into upsell, expansion, and renewal? So for example, there's a big enterprise business, one of the most well-known businesses out there. They essentially had a team last year that slid their like solutions consulting team out, and they made them just focus on low product adoption customers. And they ran all these programs to increase. It actually increased their product adoption utilization by 70% and then had a 35% increase on renewals. And so like that is where the magic bullet is, right? And so figuring that out within the organization, I think is super critical. Regardless of whatever stage you're at, but especially in the early stage.
That's huge. I'm hearing like it's almost the KPI is did the customer get the outcome that they purchased? You know, like when they purchased you, they wanted X to happen. And did you, you know, deliver on X?
You know, And that's something that I think is important to me, because we've kind of lost sight, because like a lot of the solutions engineering function has have spent most of their career justifying their existence, right? How many deals were I, what was I on? Did deals close faster if the SE was on there? Where's there more, you know, people bought more products if the SE was involved? And all those things are great, but they're not like correlation metrics, right? So obviously being involved and driving revenue is important, but I think that it's the other metrics is where the solutions engineer actually needs to move to and latch on to within the organization, because that's actually how you justify the existence of this role versus like, yeah, we know we need this role, but ratios are wildly different at every single company. And so I think I'm looking forward to seeing this profession continue to iron out like what that metric is and what those metrics are. And I think that's a really important part of this evolution that needs to happen.
Yeah. And you played a big part of it, obviously, with building Pre-Sales Collective and, you know, trying to elevate and get people to, you know, clearly define what the role is, what success looks like, the path, for the career path. Walk me through that time period. So we love, you know, stories on this podcast. Walk me through kind of first standing up Pre-Sales Collective, and then you're like, oh, wow, I think we really have something here. And then we'll get to, you know, maybe the biggest sale of your life, which is actually, you know, selling the company.
You know, Scott, I remember that Yuji and I talked to you and Max early on and like picked your brain on what mattered, right?
I remember.
Yeah. And we really appreciate your insights because you guys really did that early at Sales Hacker. I mean, you built that playbook, which is incredible. And if I look back to Pre-Sales Collective, and for those who don't know, Yuji Higashi, fellow LP as well, and I started this business because he was in Seattle and getting people together in person. I was in Chicago, and we said, hey, if you're not in one of these cities or San Francisco, where I used to live, New York, like, how do you connect with people? And the answer was that you didn't. And so we were like, hey, let's start the first pre-sales conference. And this is early 2020, right? And so we're like, well, should we do a community? Should we do a conference? We decided to do the community. And all of a sudden, pandemic happened. And I'll never forget, I had a Chicago event and I called Yuji and I said, hey, we just made our Chicago event virtual and I'm going to announce Pre-Sales Collective tonight, which was like 3 months earlier than I was supposed to. And he's like, what? I was like, I'm doing it. Actually, my words were, I'm fucking doing it. And on that call where we had like 250 people sign up in a week, we announced the Pre-Sales Collective. And then we had our first event in August. And things went nuts. I mean, I tell you, Scott, we had 1,000 people signing up at Pre-Sales Collective a week. And we decided to just take the market by storm, right? One of the things that I like to do as a leader is when everyone's zigging, try to zag, right? And COVID just happened. And so we were one of the first people with webinars, every single week webinars, stood up a Slack channel, stood up a podcast, put out content out there. And this flywheel kept growing and growing and growing. So by the end of that year, end of 2020, Yuji decided to leave Outreach and I put in my resignation at Salesforce and we went full time on this thing. And it was just an unbelievable journey. I mean, sure, look, I think we had a little bit of lightning in a bottle, but we were the first and still PSC is like one of the only companies that are servicing these professionals. And I think what I learned, right, was like, you can build a really great business in a niche, right? And there was like niches within our niche, right? And, you know, what most people don't know is, we built PSC into a multi-million dollar business. I mean, it was incredible. Obviously, again, the timing, but we had multiple business units. We had B2C offering, B2B offerings, private leadership group, free programs. It really was an incredible, incredible journey. And if I look back on it, Scott, I mean, we're pretty much actually 4 years ago from when this was about to get announced. And so what has happened in that short period of time? Yeah, you know, I feel very, very fortunate to have been on this journey and on this ride.
So cool. And congrats on all the success. It was cool to kind of watch it all unfold and really, you know, explode. And I think, yeah, you know, the learning for the folks out there is, you know, there's a lot of communities. Everyone's like, oh, we don't need another community. Like there's all these. And like, if you nail a niche, whether it's a business function or an industry, there's so many people out there that don't yet have a place that they identify with amongst their peer. And if you can own that, I mean, the power you get from just insights derived in the community. Sure, like you mentioned, you can build a multi-million dollar business, but also you can build a SaaS company on the back of it. You can do so many different things if you own that. You're building distribution for whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really great point. You know, one of the things I didn't even mention is how many people we impacted. We helped and impacted so many people, which was the most rewarding part of that entire journey. And, you know, I think we started to see more and more communities pop up. But our big thing, and one of my you know, quote that really matters to me is the details are the difference between good and great. Because you can go and create something again, but if you nail it with high execution, you have an elevated experience, there's always a market for that. There's a reason that people spend $600-$800 staying at a Four Seasons versus staying at, you know, a hotel that's a quarter of the cost or a fraction of the cost. It's the same thing, right? But it's the elevated experience. And I think for those that are even thinking about that mechanism, if you nail execution and you have very tight alignment on what you're trying to focus on, you can really make an impact and cut through the noise.
A quick pause from this interview to talk through some of my time spent inside various high growth sales organizations. It was always pretty clear to me how much time was spent on the operational bloat of actually running that organization. We were spending so much time evaluating multiple forecasting vendors, tracking down our reps to get their updated pipelines, or waiting on sales ops or rev ops to send us the dashboards we needed to do our jobs. And that was always at the expense of closing deals. If that sounds familiar to you, our partner Cinch lets you put all that hassle and headache in the past. Cinch is a single platform for all of your sales and sales ops tooling, from using natural language to build dashboards that will make your rev ops lead jealous, to getting forecasting, pipeline management, and lead routing from a single vendor. Cinch allows you to spend more time driving the business forward. If you want to learn more, head over to withcinch.com. That's with S-Y-N-C-H.com. Now back to the interview.
Well, talk me through, you know, we get a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to this. Talk me through how you went about selling the company. That's a very difficult thing to do. A lot of people, you know, hope for an acquisition or a sale. And not a lot of people talk about how that actually goes down. We'd love to hear your story there.
Yeah. You know, look, we're beneficiaries of 2020, 2021, right? We started the business in 2020, went full time in 2021 and sold by the end of that year, which was unbelievable. And if you think about that, and you know, the conversations Yuji and I had were, well, what are we doing that's unique and differentiated? Could someone repeat this? And could we find a partner that's going to accelerate our business and accelerate our growth? Because we're bootstrapped, we're doing this on our own. Yuji and I both took this job and got married in the same year, right? So like we barely took any money. We had all these other expenses. So like we had to just bust our ass to work hard to make it successful. And, you know, we started to get, if you remember, you know, summer 2021, fall 2021, things were starting to get toward that peak. And we were starting to get a lot of people reaching out to us, tech companies, tech people that we were partners with, other communities, big community businesses, other PE companies that were kind of doing this type of model. And we started to be like, we're never going to do this, right? But as we started having these discussions with all these folks, we were like, you know what? Like, if we really want to reach the potential that we want PSC to get to, and we want to make this a place that can last forever after us, we should really consider this. And Scott, I think I've told you this in separate. Like, it was the most exhilarating experience of my life. I mean, every high and low you could ever imagine. If you want to feel human, go through an acquisition process because it's unbelievable. I mean, the days that Yuji and I were like, you know, this is taking a lot of energy. Like we didn't have a legal team, you know, it was us, right? It was just us going through that and me leading the negotiation. Like it was tough. But we made a decision like, hey, if we don't get what we want, we're just not going to do this. And that's okay. And wow, what an experience. I mean, we were beat down so many times. Like, do we do this? You know, is it the right thing? And, you know, I talked to some other folks in my network who had gone through the same thing. And, you know, they told me, they said, look, if you're trying to take this community somewhere and you want it to live on forever, that's a legacy that you're not going to be able to get in a lot of other opportunities. And so, you know, you should really consider this. And because you started the business a year and a half ago, you went full time this year. If you think about the ROI on your exit, I mean, you're in a very small category. And again, it was life-changing. I can't retire from it, but it was a life-changing event. And I could change my life, my family's life. It could open up so many doors. And it was a really hard thing to do, but we did it. And, you know, what I really wanted was to celebrate that and let people know, like, hey, you can build these community businesses and they could be sold to tech companies. They could be sold to other communities. And it's an endeavor that's not just a side project. You can really invest in this to make it a full-time job that can live on. So, you know, obviously that was a lot there, but Scott, it was a wild experience. If I look back, obviously the most wild experience of my professional career.
Well, kudos to you and UNG for making it happen. And yeah, I didn't even realize the condensed timeline there, like the speed at which you were able to do that, like stand it up and then sell it. It's pretty unheard of. And also very smart timing-wise as well.
Hindsight's always 2020, you know?
Yeah, so. Yeah. Both of you genius. Just had the market fully mapped out. Yeah, you knew what was coming. No, I love it, man. That's really cool. And thanks for sharing. Okay. So you sell this business. You make some money. You can change your family's life, but not quite enough to like ride into the sunset quite yet. Well, I don't know. You're a young guy. I'm sure you wouldn't have, even if it was, tons and tons of money, but you're now just inundated with kind of all this pre-sales knowledge and like where this new motion is sort of going. And I'm sure you talk to a ton of different startups as you're kind of like, okay, what's next? Do I start something? But you have such an interesting like purview. What drew you to Sam and Testbox and got you excited about kind of this new category and this new company that you start?
Yeah. I appreciate that question. So I'm a self, proclaimed workaholic and I'm okay with it. And to your point on how much we did, I've got a whole theory that like if people are working 30 hours a week over a month, 3 months, 5 months, that's great. But look at what happens on impact and decision making when you work 50 hours or 60 hours a week, or you're working 6 days or 7 days a week. And when you do that for 12 months, 18 months, the impact is compounding. Right? It's really unbelievable. So when I decided to leave PSC after working for a parent company for 18 months, I needed to take a break. Like everyone told me, James, take a break. I've never taken more than a week or two off in my entire career. And I took a break to take a step back and just reflect, like stop and smell the roses. Like we sold the business and then went 10 times harder because we were trying to capture the market. And so I never really got a chance to reflect back and be like, okay, like, wow, that was pretty incredible. We should think about that. So I spent a couple months off the grid and then I started coming up for air and I talked to a lot of VCs, PE companies, pre-sales leaders, founders, and started to really figure out what I wanted to do. And it was very clear that to me, Pre-Sales Collective was the thing before the thing. And I wanted to go back to technology to show that I could own revenue. I could own the customer journey. And I wanted that level of accountability and responsibility. And I give Craig Rosenberg at Scale a lot of credit on this because, you know, I kind of went to him with an idea that Doug Landis and I had talked about and, you know, about like, you know, what he did in building a business and selling it to Gardner. And I talked to Craig and told him about the test box opportunity. And he was like, oh, you got to do that, James. Because we built Pre-Sales Collective on sponsorship revenue to start. And everyone in this space, in demo automation space, were my partners. So I know the space really, really well. And I know the space, you know, respectfully better than a lot of the founders of these companies. And so I was like, look, if I want to take on a new function of owning sales, owning the number, owning the customer journey, taking on marketing, why should I go learn a new industry or a new product or a new problem? I should go to demo automation because that is my best place of success. And so I started doing due diligence on a lot of these products. And I really love a lot of products in the space. I'm friends with a lot of these founders. But when I learned what TestBox was doing, because I knew of them before their pivot in the marketplace, I was like, this is revolutionary. This is wildly different than anybody else is solving the problem. And I talked to Sam and heard his vision and heard the way he was going about building this company and really the empowerment that I would get if I joined this company, which wasn't my own, but I feel like it is. it just felt like a perfect match. And so we actually dated for a little bit. I consulted a day a week for a couple months just to see how things went. Sam and I actually hung out in person at the Go-to-Market Fund retreat in Napa, which was a great chance for us to meet face-to-face. And I after those couple months, I left and I was like, this is the right career move and this is the thing I've been looking for. And Scott, I can't lie, I'm out of my comfort zone, right? I'm hired a product marketing manager. I've got a product manager because we've got a customer engineering team. Like, I'm out of my comfort zone and it's awesome. And I absolutely love it. And I think having a partner like Sam in this business is all that someone could ask for, right? He's leading by example. He's hard charging. He's getting shit done. And that's the only type of person I would ever be able to work for if I wasn't working for myself.
Hell yeah. And it's exciting to see you, you know, take the bull by the horns. We've got some cool things cooking up already. So we're going to start seeing that test launch more and more. And so, you know, I've come to know this category fairly well. Of course, we're investors. But, you know, for a listener, it is a newer category. We want to call it the demo automation category, whatever we want to call it. Category that isn't on everyone's radar yet. I think it should be. I think it will be soon. But tell me a little bit about kind of the problems that this category is going to solve.
So right now, the category is considered demo automation. It's G2's fastest growing category, but there are products that do wildly different things inside of this, right? For example, you might have a product tour like a Novatic, right, company that screenshots on a website, HTML capture, so that when someone comes to their website, they can get that experience before going and requesting a live demo. You have companies like Consensus who do videos, right? You come in, you say who you are, what you're interested in, and it gives you those videos. But my issue with the whole space is that people don't buy off seeing screenshots, unless it's like, you know, a B2C offering. Like no one's, they want to see the real product. And so what has happened in demo automation is you've kind of got this segmentation between the product tours and then the live solution. So at TestBox, we empower your go-to-market organization. So companies love using us because we can showcase a best-in-class version of your product, most likely better than you can. So for example, like Gong is a big customer. Gong, you know, has a lot of amazing AI and ML, but for them to get their demo environment to do that, it was really hard. It took 5 product managers and we were able to solve that problem for them. And now we're a great partner for them. You know, there's other amazing companies like Apollo.io that, you know, they can't show the full power of their product on their own. And so utilizing a product like ours, which is actually live and integrated version of your product, it's unbelievable. Because what else exists out there are like copies and clones and filters, but nothing is doing what we're doing from a live perspective. So like we really are empowering hundreds of sales reps to be able to showcase the product, give your customer a proof of concept without having to go get your SE involved, having to go spend 6, 7, 8 hours building demo environments and actually get those buyer analytics on what people are looking at in your product so that now you actually understand who's qualified and who's not qualified. So again, it's a very dynamic product. It's very different than what exists in the market. You know, personally, I'm talking a lot with G2. We're actually doing some partnerships with some of the product tours to help educate the space. And so just one piece on this is like, I look at marketing at the top of my sales funnel as customer education because people think that they know the space, but they don't know the difference between my product and, you know, product A, B, C, and D. And if you go to the websites, they all sound the same. And so that's my job right now. And I think that I based on my experience with Presales Collective, my relationships with these folks in this category is working together to bring education to the category, to bring segmentation to the category and help bring differentiation so people buy these products and realize the value that they bring, because some of these companies have been overselling and it's not good for anybody.
Yeah. The old rising tide raises all ships is always a good one when you're starting to build a category. And you know, there's going to be customers that are better suited to your competitors in the early days, and you're going to be able to serve some better. So segmentation in the category is super, super important. And I'm glad that you're, you know, beating that drum. You also said something offline before we started this that kind of excited me. And it sounds like maybe a future state of TestBox, but I think it's really cool is you said something along the lines of, you know, we're going to be able to show people and they'll interact with what your product could look like in like 2-3 years. Like imagine being able to have like a real, you know, instead of like product roadmap, it's like, here's what is coming and you can play around and you can check it out. Like that's a dream for a sales rep.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of times, a lot of sales reps are out there showcasing their demo environment and it doesn't actually tell a good story, right? It's got some good data. It's got outdated data. It doesn't have good reporting. But that's actually what we do now is like your current functionality, it's all there, right? And it's like somebody had been using your product for years so they can realize the value. They can see the integrations. And I think from like a future perspective, we want to do a lot around that proof of concept, right? Where you're going to get it in the customer's hands because they want to test the live product versus maybe looking at some screenshots and all that other stuff that comes with it to guide them through there. A lot of the AI features that are starting to come out and some different technologies there. It's going to be very, very powerful. And one of the things that we want to continue to highlight is the integration, like taking what people are looking at, taking those buying signals and send those to your CRM, your conversation analytics platform, send those to all these other places so that, you know, you can really figure out what people are doing, what they're doing with your product and where they're seeing value. So that's what's really exciting for us.
You mentioned, AI and the rise of LLMs now a few times. And I think from an outside perspective, it seems like you're in the right place at the right time because you have sort of these cosmic shifts that happen in technology, right? With like mobile, with cloud, and now AI. And I think back of when, you know, I was at a digital asset management software company, and this is still when people were kind of scared of the cloud. And like, and if I had something like a test box that could show, like, okay, this is what life's going to be like in the cloud, it's not that scary. And people are at that same point with kind of AI right now. They're like, okay, we implement this and then what? How's it going to affect things over here? And they're scared. And so it's like a perfect time to have live trials exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the reasons people come to us is because they can't get their AI and ML products to do what they need it to do on demos and for customers. And customers don't believe that it can do that. So we can build the data model and data story so that they can test and see it. It's unbelievable. I mean, we actually get doubters. They're like, you guys can't actually do that. And we're like, yeah, let's show you that we can do that. And, I've been doing, Scott, a lot of research on AI. It was actually one of the things I also did in my time off is I held 10 roundtables with executives talking about AI and their businesses. And I think there is a lot of, you know, hesitation around AI, but AI is really going to augment us at the end of the day. It's going to make us better at our jobs. We're going to take those meaningless tasks, those redundant tasks that nobody likes, and it's going to just be able to supercharge us to be better at our jobs. And so you're right. We're still at that cusp of like where people are a little bit concerned about it. But what I could tell you is that the folks that are on the bleeding edge are building an advantage. And that is very clear on all the conversations that I've had with folks.
For sure. I think a lot of where we're headed with AI and a lot of professional functions is like, I would love if my whole day was just basically made like making decisions. Those are the highest impact things I can do is make decisions all day. And then my AI agents just go and act on those decisions. And that's where we're headed in a lot of
it is, Scott. I love that. And because, you know, what most people don't realize, well, it's starting to get more popular now. What LLMs are really good at doing in this new Gen AI is taking a bunch of information, synthesizing it, and serving that up, right? Reading a 10K takes an hour or two. Imagine when you just get the cliff notes of it. Imagine you get the cliff notes and then you get all the customer conversations that have happened over the last 6 months. And you've got context into this area and this area. And you've got everything summarized, you're right, to make those decisions. I think that's any executive's dream, right? If you don't want to be in the weeds getting all the historical context and this and that, it's very subjective. You know, it's like if you can get objective data to make decisions, it's going to be amazing. So I like your point of view there.
Yeah, I'm excited for that future state. We're a little ways away still, but this has been awesome, man. You're such a pro, and lots of great learnings in this one. And appreciate you sharing your story. As we sort of wrap up, I got two more questions for you, and I keep these always the same.
listeners know, they're intentionally vague, so you can take it anywhere you want to go. You can reiterate something we talked about, or something completely net new. First question is, what is one widely held belief revenue leaders hold today that you think is bullshit or no longer serving?
That people actually care about their customers. I think it's bullshit. You know, I think that the way business has operated over the last 12 years, you care about the chase, you care about getting net new business in, and you have no or very little incentive to give a shit on what happens with that customer. And if you look at like what's happening with like, everyone's talking about buying being broken, sales being broken, people are beat down in their buying process because they're not just talking to you and all your competitors, they're talking all internally with all this consensus building. And then they got to get onboarded. And then some of these organizations, they don't even touch base with you. They don't even make sure you're finding value in the product. And so I think the idea that people actually give a shit about their customers is a strong fact in a lot of places, whether people want to agree with that or not. I will say that I think I'm really looking forward to the increased emphasis on like NDR, because I think no longer are we in a world where you could just sell any customer and just bring in net new business somewhere else. Like, you've got to work that install base. You need renewals to happen. You need to get expansion, because it's a lot easier to sell to current customers than new customers right now. And if you haven't given a shit about them, because after you've signed that dotted line, you're nowhere to be found, churn's coming for you.
Yeah. It's insanely true. And I'll give you an example of how true it is. We just purchased some software recently, decent expense for us. And they were so great and so responsive. And then we signed. And the day we get handed off to CS, our CX, who we haven't talked to, never met, goes on vacation for a week. And like, there was nothing. It was entire functionality that we'd been promised that was going to be built out was not built out. And this is just like, honestly, I haven't fully like onboarded a new technology. Like, a lot of it has been self-serve recently. And this is like my first experience in a while. And this is like how bad it is pretty shocking. I'm not going to throw them under the bus because we do like the tool and it's doing well, but it's crazy. And so I agree with you there. And something's got to give. I think people are waking up to, you know, we're in the business of recurring revenue. But I think you can highlight how true that is by how much time is spent in board meetings, in executive meetings, talking about the net new them. Like, it's probably 90% of the discussion versus, you know, the retention. And so that we got to put the buyer first again. All right. And then the final question is, you know, it's tough times out there. People are looking for anything that's sort of working. You know, in this new role at TestBox, what's one tactic or strategy that's been working for you guys?
Yeah, I thought about this question. I think there's a lot of ways to take this, but if I look back at my career, I had a lot of people who gave me great guidance. They always reached out, you know, when I needed something, or always were there when I reached out. And just being able to give back to folks, I found that, you know, maybe it was because my business, a pre-sales collective, like, that's what I did and that's core to my DNA. Now that I'm in this go-to-market motion at TestBox, it is repaying me in droves, right? It is repaying me in droves. And so I think that, you know, the theme that does apply to, right, is people are saying cold outbound's dead, you know, whatever, right, is the new headline right now. But the idea of going to your network where you've already got relationships and you've got warm relationships and understanding if, you know, your software is a fit for someone is really, really important. I think also playing the long game on that as well is like, might not be a fit now, doesn't mean you just need to disregard someone and talk to him, you know, not talk to them for 6 to 12 months. Like, keep those touch points, check in with people because you want to be top of mind for them. And so I think it requires a lot of extra effort. It obviously requires a lot of intention as well, but I think that the rewards are plentiful.
The long game is the only game, and I've been fortunate to reap the benefits of that. And like, the network really becomes, you know, it's everything as you grow. Making you, we talk a lot about this idea of like ecosystem-led growth. It is kind of the biggest hack
ever. But the only problem with the hack is it takes time, and because you have to build trust, and trust takes time. And so it is a long game, but it's one worth playing. I love it, Nam. Well, James, I'm excited to hang with you next week in person. It's been a while. Drink some wine, have some barbecue. Should be a good time, and super excited to see what you're going to be able to do at TestBox. I would urge everyone to check them out. It's such a cool platform. I'm a huge fan. And are you hiring for any roles right now?
We are, Scott. I appreciate that question. I appreciate that as well. We are hiring for a number of roles. So if you go to testbox.com/careers, we've got about 3 or 4 open roles now and plan on opening a couple more over the next quarter or two. And so we've actually got a couple things cooking, and if a couple things actually work out, we're going to have a little bit bigger of a hiring blitz. So let's see what happens. We've got some good customers that will open up and unlock some opportunities. So yeah, I appreciate that plug. Definitely check out our website or just reach out to me on LinkedIn. And also, Scott, I just want to say thanks to you and the GTM Fund team. And you know, one, being an LP, part of GTM Fund, I think is super special, right? As someone who built community, I just love what you're doing. And you know, even for you and Max and the guidance that you gave us early on, super imperative. So thanks again for that. And you know, thanks again for having me on the podcast today.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. And to all the listeners, thank you as well. We appreciate you. We know there's a lot of areas and resources out there, so we don't take it for granted that you hang out with us every week. And I always say it, but listening is one thing, executing is something totally different. So hopefully you can take some of these lessons, strategies, apply them in your business, and go scale. All right, see you next week.